KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, did the Academy's documentary shortlist short some docs? Plus, Hugo Chavez takes on Hollywood. Stay close. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
In the early 90s, Academy members who were voting on feature-length documentaries went to screenings where they were given tiny flashlights. If enough flashlights were turned on after 15 minutes, that was it. The screening was stopped, the movie was gonged. But that wasn't the most egregious part of the process. The 0 to 10 voting scale could be gamed. Academy members could vote 10 for the movies they liked and 0 for the rest. That system was finally discarded after a small number of voters killed the chances of the remarkable basketball documentary Hoop Dreams in 1995. It didn't even get a nomination. But even with the changes, the documentary category has continued to be controversial, and this year is no different. The 15 films shortlisted for possible nomination included some great titles, but the list did not include a number of high-profile docs. Michael Moore's self-described career capper, Capitalism, A Love Story, and James Toback's Tyson. The exclusion of Tyson could turn into a real brawl, since Toback alleged in the New York Times that some sort of extortion attempt kept his film from making the short list. Extortion, by the way, is his word, and he has yet to explain what that means. He also called the voters in the category a tiny, dirty, covert, weirdly protective little group. We tried to get a hold of Toback, but he declined to comment. We did reach Bruce Davis, executive director of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So how is it that we have so much controversy this year? I mean, is it every year, or is it just that the better-known movies were left out this year?
Well, historically, there used to be years when there were, I thought, valid reasons for complaints. We used to do the doc features in a kind of a bizarre way, where many of the voters were not documentary filmmakers, and I think in those years we did make some curious choices.
Is that the year we're talking about, the process that led to Hoop Dreams famously being excluded?
Yes.
Okay.
And but beginning in 2001, the documentarians got their own branch, and since that time, it's been a little harder to complain because now you have only documentary filmmakers making these judgments. And while I wouldn't quite say sour grapes is what's going on this year, I think every filmmaker thinks his or her film is a knockout when they submit it, and there is a genuine feeling of shock when they don't make that first cut. Now, that's from the filmmaker's point of view. What I think goes on from the point of view of the press is that there are a couple of titles every year that people have heard of. And if those aren't on the list, they think, well, there must be something wrong here. But they haven't seen all the 89 films, which the voters have. And usually when people start catching up to those titles that aren't familiar, they say, oh, yeah, well, that's a pretty good film, too. So I'm just waiting for the press to catch up with us this year.
Is it possible that the Academy members have a reverse thing and they just kind of are prejudiced against commercially successful documentaries? Because we've seen some, you know, high-profile films in the past, Thin Blue Line, Touching the Void, that did not get into contention. Is that, what's that about?
Well, I think, again, that's about, I'd have to look up when Touching the Void was but there were other reasons a documentarian might not admire that particular movie, and I'm not going to go into them.
Okay.
But Thin Blue Line, of course, was before the current system was established, and I think these days there are genuinely defensible reasons for leaving some high-profile films out, and you're beginning to see those now in the days following the shortlist. I noticed the blogs are starting to catch up and say, well, that wasn't really that great, you know, and this other one, which you haven't heard of, was pretty good. So, you know, you're never going to make everybody happy. No one will ever agree. No one person will ever agree that everything was perfectly done, but still, we're moving toward a pretty defensible list here.
Give us a outline of the process for nominating feature-length documentaries for Oscar consideration.
Okay. This was an interesting year in a couple of different ways, not least because we had huge number of entries again. 89 feature-length documentaries qualified. That basically requires a one-week run in New York, in Manhattan, and then a one-week run in Los Angeles County. And then we asked the documentary branch, the specialists in documentary filmmaking in the Academy, to volunteer to look at a large subsection of them. And everybody in the branch is eligible unless they have a horse in the race. In a year when you have a movie contending, you may not vote until the nominations come out. So that first pass gives us a short list of anywhere from 12 to 15 films. This year it was 15. And then that same group of voters bears down and looks at the however many of the 15 they haven't seen yet individually, and the nominations, the five nominees, will come out of that.
Well, so when we get to that winnowing process, you have how many different people looking at how many different films?
Well, we know it's 89 films.
Right.
And the branch is made up of about 150 people, 151 as of last week. And a huge percentage of them participate. I've indicated that the ones who have a film in the running can't participate.
Right.
But
I volunteer, and am I meant to watch a certain number of movies? Do you tell me which movies
we
to watch?
No. We divide the movies up in a very random way, and we try to keep it under 20 films that any one individual has to watch. Basically, this year there were five different groups of films, and they are sent to the various members.
So you take the 80-some and divide them by five?
Yes.
So if I volunteered, you would send me a dozen-plus movies, and I would then be expected to watch all of them and make my ranking.
Right.
On my little DVD player at home.
Yes. You've got a couple of months to do this, but still, it's a lot of viewing, no question.
Now, I realize you have to say yes to this, but you feel confident at this point, yes, that the list is the right, this system is the right system.
Well, I'd be happy to hear your suggestion for a better one. You let the artists who make this kind of movie decide what they think should move on in the competition, and I don't know a better way to do it than that.
Bruce Davis is the Executive Director of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Thank you so much for being with us.
You are very welcome.
Okay, so that's the Academy side of things, but how do things look to the contenders? Howard Cohen is co-president of Roadside Attractions, a respected indie distributor that's had Oscar hopefuls in the feature, foreign, and documentary categories. This year, his company had three docs that could have been considered Oscar-worthy. The Cove, a film about dolphins in danger, made the short list. But Chris Rock's Good Hair and the Anna Wintour Profile, the September issue, did not. Now, you've said you were dismayed by the results for this shortlist this year. Why?
Yeah, that was taking a little out of context because, obviously I'm pleased about The Cove and I'm dismayed for Good Hair and the September issue. And, I was also dismayed for some of the other really worthy ones like Anvil, which I loved. You know, I mean, they were
which was not your movie, to be clear.
Not our film.
Right.
I mean, but I still loved it. You know, I think that I was dismayed because they seem to be sort of continuing that direction where political content seems to have more weight than populist entertainment. I mean, I actually called them this morning to ask them, you know, just so I could be clear. I said, what is the purpose of the shortlist? And they said, it's to help publicize the category. It's sort of like the semifinals in sports, I guess. So what is the purpose of it? And if the ultimate purpose is to get more people to appreciate documentary as a form, which I'm going to extrapolate is the ultimate purpose, I think kind of being slightly biased against what I would call pop docs is perhaps at cross purposes with that ultimate goal. You know, these are movies that are having a dialogue with the culture. They are documentaries, and you know, these are often very well-reviewed documentaries. Both September Issue and Good Hair are movies that are extremely well-reviewed, and you know, they are having a dialogue with the culture that some of the movies on that shortlist do not and never will.
I mean, I think the criteria is sort of generally excellence, right?
But you know, what is excellent? You know, what, excellent in a vacuum to whom? I don't know.
But how would they direct people? Okay, we want it to be the best, but we also want it to be kind of popular. I mean, how could they direct that to their members that are reviewing these films?
I think they're making theatrical distribution a
criterion.
A criterion. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it, are they doing themselves any favors with these docu-weeks and minimalistic theatrical, you know, qualification? That's another question.
So would you propose that they have to make a certain amount of money?
No, I don't think it should be. It definitely shouldn't be that, because that would be very artificial. But I think that a certain level of distribution beyond, you know, a paid week in a New York theater and an L.A. theater, that's clearly not doing what they want it to do.
Right. So basically you want some proof that people actually went to see this movie.
Yeah, or something that makes it more theatrical. And so, you know, they're going the other extreme. So the other extreme now is it qualifies for a week, so you can call it on the surface of a theatrical, and then the movies that are truly theatrical films that are interacting with people and that are furthering theatrical documentary are getting ignored. You know, it's got to be somewhere in the middle. Like, yes, it should not just be box office. That would be sort of craven and wouldn't work. So it's a middle ground that they're missing.
Anything else that you would think needs to be looked at?
You know, it's a good question whether the way they do the foreign languages, they have a principal committee and then they have another committee. They have not yet done that with documentaries, and that might be interesting to do that as well, so that there's another point of view. Because, you know, there was a question about the Foreign Language Committee, whether that group of people, frankly, the group of people that have time to sit and watch 70 movies are necessarily the same people you want making the decision. And so they added a second group that sort of vetted the first group.
And this, people are still complaining, of course, but
yeah, but it's gotten better.
Yeah,
foreign language has definitely gotten better, and you know, films that sort of the general, you know, powers that be or minds in Hollywood think should have been nominated are more often getting nominated, and I think that's when these systems usually cry out for change, is when a bunch of films that most, you know, intelligent people would agree should have been on don't get on, then usually they try and change.
I have to say they're a little mysterious about, they wouldn't even tell us the number of people that are looking at these films when we asked.
I've heard 125 and I've heard 180, so I actually don't know. I probably have a way to find out. I don't know. It's somewhere under 200, let's put it that way. It's a very small group of people.
And they split up the films, apparently.
And they split up the films because no one can be asked or expected to watch 89 films. So that is a quirk of the process. There, let's say 20 people watched Good Hair and Anvil and the September Issue and Capitalism and a number of the other sort of profile films that didn't get included. Well, it's an easy possibility that those 20 didn't like it, and they may not be a good proxy for, you know, quality documentary filmmaking as a whole. it's 20 people. So the process depends on a random sampling of 20 people being a proxy for the art of documentary filmmaking.
So another level of review might actually
exactly
help.
Exactly.
Anything else that you see out there?
No, I mean, look, the only thing I'd like to say is that I am aware of how difficult a process this is, and I'm very appreciative that they keep trying, and you know, they are very smart about it. They you know, they listen. You know, it's sort of like the Supreme Court. They can't change the rules overnight because then they'd be changed 100 times. They have to really see how it's working over a period of time, and so I appreciate it. And it's not just like, oh, sour grapes, my two movies should have been nominated along with my third one. Because I appreciate that different people are going to have different views, and especially documentary filmmakers may, you know, are going to view quality in a certain way.
Now, do you know, we've been sort of mystified because Jim Toback said that his movie wasn't nominated because of an extortion
attempt. I wanted to refer to that, but no, I wish I had some of the juicy details. But it makes me laugh because what is a shortlist worth? You know, like, what was he paid? You know, what did he want to be, what did someone ask to be paid? And like, could a single person really make a difference? It's hilarious to me.
Well, nobody tried to extort you.
No one has tried to extort
money in a paper bag. And
No. I mean, I am fascinated to know, but I was thinking about the logistics and thinking it was like a scene out of, you know, The Player. Like, what could you possibly offer?
Well, what do you get? What would you get? Are these worth something to you? Is a short list?
It's very questionable. I mean, I think for a filmmaker, perhaps it's worth more than anything, you know, to get nominated, versus for the distributor, where there's more sort of a, you know, you have to ask a lot of questions because you have to spend a lot of money, you know, if the movie gets nominated in that last month. So I think that you know, there's a real question, more of a question mark for the distributor, but for a director, it's definitely a huge thing. So I could imagine it being worth something. What that is, I don't know.
So you will spend more money on The Cove now to promote it.
Yes.
And meanwhile, Good Hair and September Issue, it's been fun, but those deals are done. They've got their distribution.
Well, we're spending money to release them on DVD. Both of them are coming out in February, so we're spending money on that.
Right.
But we're not going to spend money on awards.
I mean,
there'll be 10 best lists and other things. Maybe they'll get nominated for a Spirit Award. But generally, the advertising, which is the real money you spend, is usually connected to the Oscars.
And if you actually did win in Best Documentary, would that be worth something?
I think it definitely is worth something for the continued DVD release of an Oscar-winning film. Yes, I do.
So if this may be an awkward question, but if you had a movie that was nominated, say The Cove, would you be like, damn, I just can't believe it. We're never going to win, and now we have to spend all this money.
Yeah, I think there's disappointment. I think you still have to spend wisely, and we're an independent, and we would never spend the money that the studios would spend. I mean, you know, it might be a program of 5 ads in Variety and a bunch of screenings. We're not talking millions of dollars.
Right.
So, I you know, it's not like it's money down the drain. It's just, it's definitely money, and, you know, in the independent world, we spend money very, very carefully.
Well, good luck.
Thank you. No, we are very excited about The Cove, and we're having fun with the process, and we've calmed down our sadder filmmakers who didn't get nominated, and by the way, both of those movies were successful at the box office, so that's its own reward.
That is quite a consolation. Yeah, Howard Cohen is co-president of Roadside Attractions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
During the Greek era, it was punishable by death to harm a dolphin.
We've lost that somewhere, that respect.
It's so bizarre because if you didn't know what's going on over here, you would think this is a town that loves dolphins and whales.
When we first got in the country, we'll be back in a minute with a word from our man in Venezuela. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. We'd love to know what you think. Write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. Or go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. First there was Hollywood, then came Bollywood, and even Nigeria's Nollywood. And now, Venezuela's petro-populist president, Hugo Chavez, has spent millions on a studio to beat the Americans at their own game. The official name of his new movie machine is Cinemaville. But, as Newsweek special correspondent Mac Margolis wrote in a recent article, most Venezuelans just call it Hugowood. The business producer Matt Holzman recently spoke to Margolis about his piece, Lights, Camera, Revolución.
So, Mac, tell me how you happened to take a visit to Hugowood, as it's been called.
Well, it was one of those stories that I'd always wanted to do ever since Hugo Chavez started this film studio in 2006. Chavez made no bones about the fact that he was challenging Hollywood, what he called the tyranny of Hollywood and the dictatorship of violence, sex, shopping, and all of that. And I was just curious to know what a revolutionary film studio, which is what he claims it is, looked like.
So what had you been told to expect, and then what did you encounter?
Well, it was a bit of a letdown. I was expecting, you know, something lavish. What I found was a sort of a glorified strip mall kind of architecture with bleached concrete and glass in a very sleepy bedroom community outside of Caracas. And there was a man-made canal and a fountain, but no water. Got inside, and a very enthusiastic PR aide showed me around, and her kind of looked like they'd hired Miss Venezuela to receive the press. And she took me around to empty studios and lonely edit rooms. It looked like a ghost town because apparently an electrical fire a month or so before had just knocked most of the studios out of operation, and they were working supposedly, reportedly, elsewhere.
They have produced movies. Movies have come out of this complex.
Oh, yeah, they have, and they're going to produce two this year. A third, I believe, is coming out in November, and they have quite a distribution network behind it because part of the logic is you don't just make films in order to get them to the people, which is their goal. You have to hawk them, and since commercial theaters are not going to be your likely market, then you have to do your own distribution network.
You're saying the commercial theaters won't play these movies for the most part. So
most commercial theaters don't want to have anything to do with these, in part because the quality also has not been up to snuff.
So is Chavez going to build theaters?
No, he's not going to build theaters. He's trying to work the alternative circuit. And really take the movies to the people instead of having people come to the theater. Take these DVDs and show them in town halls, in community centers, in schools, in the slums.
And how have their homegrown movies done, especially compared to American imports?
Pretty dismally. the irony here is that a lot of talent goes into these movies. Venezuela has a lot of expertise in making motion pictures, or at least in making television, especially soap operas. And the people in those industries are glad for a work opportunity, and Chavez gave that to them. So the production values are interesting. They do it right, and they work hard on making it seem vivid and real. But they just don't seem to have gone over very well with the people. You know, all the big Hollywood fare really is the box office winner.
You say Cinemaville's top draw this year, Libertador Morales, the Justice Maker, grossed roughly $200,000 against Venezuelan box office receipts for more than $11 million for Ice Age 3. So, yeah, that's not so good.
No, it is nowhere near the top 10 movies in Venezuela. So, you know, it's clearly Venezuelan viewers are voting, and they're not voting for Hugo.
Mac, have you seen any of the movies that have come out of Hugowood?
I sat down and looked at three or four of them, the ones that they handed out. One long documentary, very impassioned documentary about the Venezuelan oil industry and how basically Hugo Chavez saved that from rapacious Texans. The big hit to date, which is called Miranda Returns, about an 18th to 19th century independence hero who is kind of a three musketeers in one, but for the revolution.
And what'd you think?
It's sort of like a soap opera on steroids. It just goes on and on and on, and the heart's in the right place. And at the end, I was almost rooting for Spain.
So it sounds like you're saying that Chavez wants to challenge Hollywood, but that so far Hollywood doesn't have anything to worry about.
Not so far. Although, interestingly, Hollywood, at least some people in Hollywood, are fascinated by this. And Hugo has had a regular stream of big-name stars, Sean Penn, Tim Robbins, Kevin Spacey, of course, Danny Glover, who has been a number of times, played in a cameo role in one of the films and was supposed to have signed a deal with Chavez to make a movie in Venezuela. They seem to love the place. And so it seems to ignite something in the imaginations of Hollywood stars who earn a lot of money but have kind of a rebel flame in their heart.
There's something about the idea of being part of the big fight that appeals to them.
It's a fairly easy fight because it's not on your territory, so it's sort of easy to make revolution on someone else's turf.
Right. You don't have to give up your Mercedes at home.
Exactly. And when you fly in, you're not subject to the 3-minute showers that the Venezuelans are now restricted to, or not even the traffic, the horrific traffic, because most of these people get helicoptered around.
Nice. You know, if this really is largely an ideological battle that Hugo Chavez is fighting against the United States and against Hollywood, why not just ban the movies?
I think that would be a revolution too far. You know, he knows that it's not that he's afraid of intimidating the middle class, but that would send a lot of ordinary Venezuelans into a tizzy if, you know, you not only get them out of the shower early and say you can't sing in the shower, but if you tell them, oh, okay, you know, you can't go to the movies that everybody else on the globe is seeing. You know, Venezuelans are very sophisticated people in a way. They're very plugged in. They're very into the internet. So they're aware of what else is happening on the planet, and to turn it into Cuba with 27 million people is a huge challenge.
Do you think that that Hugo Chavez has any desire to write or direct a film?
That's a good question. I think Hugo Chavez has a movie in his head, and his movie is A New Venezuela. He's trying to script that in politics, in Congress, in the economy, and I think this is sort of a luxury to have a movie studio to do that, too. I don't think he has any desire to sit down in a director's chair, but he certainly wants other people to do that for them, and it's no coincidence that most of the movies that come out of his studios are about heroes who are a lot like him at the end of the day.
Mac Margolis is a special correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He's based in Rio, where we spoke with him. His article about Hugo Wood, Hugo Chavez's new, relatively new movie studio, is called Lights, Camera, Revolution. Thank you, Mac.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is our associate producer. Our theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.